You're listening to the Wanderlust Swingers podcast with Aussie hosts Kate and Daryl. If you're curious about exploring your sexuality or the swinging, hot-wifing and non-monogamous lifestyle, you've definitely come to the right podcast. Or maybe you just love travel adventures. Either way, we share our personal, sometimes juicy, sexy stories as well as swingers club and event reviews, interviews with other sassy people and of course our global swinging adventures. We try to bring you a look into the diverse lifestyle that the swinging and non-monogamous community has. We hope you enjoy. Now let's get into the episode. G'day everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Wanderlust Swingers podcast. This is actually volume 7 and we are continuing our Swingers Health series. I'm really excited to dig into another item here today in the Swingers Health Sexual Health series, which is again about STIs, but this time we're talking about prevention of STIs. We've spoken in the past about STI testing. Now we're going to talk about prevention, and specifically we're going to shed some light on a product called DoxyPep. It's a medication used to prevent various STIs after potential exposure. So get ready for this informative discussion. I have two experts on the line. Actually, I'm really excited to welcome them back because they were with us for volume one. I have Robert on the phone. Robert is the founder and director of Shameless Care. Welcome to the show again, Robert.
Thank you.
And I have a Dr. Stower, who's an OBGYN, a chronic pelvic and sexual pain dysfunction specialist based in Texas. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Or should I say welcome back to the both of you. So you may remember that Robert is actually based in Chicago with his partner, has been in the lifestyle for more than 15 years and operates Shameless Care, which is a non-monogamous based health support system. And Dr. Stower is, of course, a member of the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health, passionate about education, and I love this from last time, narcotic-free surgery. So two experts on the line, we're going to dig into DoxyPep. But as we get started here, Dr. Stower, I got to ask, why are you so passionate about sexual health within the non-monogamous community specifically?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different reasons that I'm passionate about this. As an OBGYN, I've always been passionate about sexual health just in general, especially the lack thereof for women, which is an unfortunate problem that we have. As far as otherwise, my husband and I are also sexually non-monogamous. And so this is a little bit more of a pain point there as well, making sure that people that are in alternative sexual lifestyles have access to good healthcare with appropriate recommendations for their lifestyle.
That's so true. Yes. I mean, one of the biggest topics we talk about, especially as it pertains to STIs, is about, you know, shame and judgment free support services. So I love the fact that you see that not only from, you know, just your general everyday work, but that you also see it from within the non-monogamous space. So that's excellent. Now, Robert, tell us a little bit about your thoughts. And I'm just going to throw it out there. It's a very broad topic, but I'm going to say the non-monogamous community and STIs, and I'm going to let you just roll with whatever your thoughts are about that, Robert.
Fantastic. Well, this is a topic that I'm very passionate about. I'm getting more and more passionate about as we get more and more STI results in from swingers all across the country. And we've now tested thousands of people over the past couple of years. And my thoughts on this are that people in the lifestyle are very progressive on STIs. And, you know, if you ask somebody in the lifestyle, should you get tested? They will say, absolutely. Everyone should be getting tested. And they are getting tested. They're getting tested multiple times per year. But the unfortunate truth is that most of them still don't know their STI status. And that's not their fault. It's just this kind of incomplete testing that a lot of people get from their physicians or their local STI clinic sometimes. I'll give you just one example, which is Mycoplasma genitalium, which about 1% to 2% of the population has. And this isn't 1% to 2% of the population, you know, presenting at an STI clinic, my genitals hurt, I can't pee. This is 1% or 2% of the population just walking around. And if your listeners out there are asking themselves, gee, I wonder if I've been tested for Mycoplasma genitalium, I can tell you right now, the answer is you haven't. And the risk of Mycoplasma genitalium actually goes up by about 10% for each new sexual partner that somebody has. And condom usage is positively correlated with a higher risk of mycoplasma. Now, it's not that condoms cause Mycoplasma genitalium. It's just that it can spread by oral sex, like a lot of the STIs that we're using today. So I dare say that while swingers are really progressive on STIs and really bullish on getting STI tested, the unfortunate truth is that most of them don't know their STI status. And isn't that the whole point of getting STIs tested, is to know your STI status?
Yeah, that's true. And I think there is so much debate out there. I mean, even within our community, I tell you what, a surefire way to get people fired up is to talk about STIs, because everybody has a different, schedule regime. Some people do the one-off, you know, so I might get tested now, Daryl gets tested in 3 months, then I roll back in 3 months after that. And everybody has an opinion about this, definitely. What schedule, what they get tested for, how they get tested, who they get tested by. So definitely a surefire way to, like I said, fire people up in the lifestyle is to start talking about STIs. So with that being said, let's just roll into the topic here of STIs, and specifically of DoxyPep. Segment one, we're going to talk about what is DoxyPep. If you haven't heard this term before, let me break it down for you a little bit. So it's a mechanism of action and the scenarios where it becomes a valuable tool in the prevention of STIs. We're not talking about testing here, we're talking about the actual prevention of STIs. So we're going to explore some of the science behind it and understand how it might or may not fit into the landscape of non-monogamy, really. So what is DoxyPep? I just want to mention that PEP stands for post-exposure prophylaxis, which is something I learned today in preparation for the interview. So let's talk about it. Dr. Stoa or Robert, can you please provide a brief overview of what DoxyPep is and how it might function as a post-exposure prophylaxis for sexually transmitted infections?
Okay, so DoxyPep, that is very important to know that it is PEP and not PREP. So PREP would be pre-exposure prophylaxis. So you take the medication before you're potentially exposed. PEP is PEP, which is post-exposure prophylaxis. So that's kind of a big difference in this one. So an overview of DoxyPep. So Doxy is a tetracycline type of antibiotic, which can be used for all sorts of things. Most often people would probably know of it for stuff like acne.
Yeah.
Really common use for acne. There's other things like Rocky Mountain spotted fever, rosacea that it can be used for, but most commonly acne. That's where people would be familiar with it. But it also can be used for preventing certain types of sexually transmitted infections when you take it right after sex, specifically gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis. And I know in the United States, there's been a lovely little resurgence of syphilis recently. In our area in Texas, it started kind of kicking up about 5-6 years ago, and now there's kind of a syphilis resurgence all across the United States. So that is one that this does cover for. So it's basically a medication that you take after sex in order to prevent those particular three sexually transmitted infections.
And interestingly, you just mentioned there about the treatment that it's this particular medication has been used for in other assets. You mentioned rosacea, for example. In my research, I was very surprised to find all of that historical research, because normally when a new drug gets introduced to the market, we go, oh, this is new, and there's an element of, confusion about it or skepticism, really. But this medication has actually been around for a really, really long time. It's just that they've now, over the past couple of years, really started to look into using this particular drug for a different result, right? So that was something that I found really intriguing. With the potential risks and benefits, what would be the primary scenarios where individuals might consider taking DoxyPep? And I might actually throw that over to you, Robert, being somebody who's in the non-monogamous lifestyle and operating a company like this and operating events, et cetera, around the country. Why would somebody in the non-monogamous lifestyle, or what scenario might play out where they would actually use DoxyPep?
Absolutely. Well, all three of those STIs can spread by oral sex. And those of us in the lifestyle have a pretty good understanding of how most people have sex in the lifestyle, which is kind of a religious zeal almost for using condoms for penis and vaginal sex or penis and anus sex, but sort of no holds barred more or less for oral sex. And I heard Dr. Storr say the other day that basically she's never even seen a dental dam in real life. And I must say I'm in the same exact situation. I've been to hedonism, 7 or 8 times, been to clubs all over the United States that people, generally speaking, have unprotected oral sex. So I personally use DoxyPep after I have sex with someone other than my primary partner, even if I'm using a condom for penis and vaginal sex, because of that risk from oral sex. And I'm actually somebody that's had gonorrhea in the past. So, but for me as a male and just playing, a handful of times a year, it's something that makes sense for me. It doesn't make sense for everybody, and we'll get into that later. But for me, that's when it makes a lot of sense. And that's when I particularly use it.
Perfect. And you just actually led me into my next question beautifully, and I'm going to still keep it in your court over here, Robert. But when you're thinking about using this type of medication, when you're thinking about your personal activities in the lifestyle, or even what you see within the community, again, from your events in the club or going to hedonism, et cetera, what do you consider exposure? Because when most people talk about it, we think, oh yeah, that's because there's been bareback play, or, you know, there's been no barrier play. So what would you consider exposure?
Well, sex is pretty messy, right? And I feel like there's, in the lifestyle, the reason why people play the way they do and use condoms in the way that they do and not in the way that they don't, I know that was a little bit confusing, but a lot of it is more so about ritual and history, and we learn from each other more than, you know, actual science. So for example, Kate, if I was going to have sex with a woman I met at hedonism, right? And I know this is going to be a gross illustration, but hear me out, everybody. Let's pretend that she was excreting black dye from her mouth. Her saliva is now black dye, just for the illustrative purposes of, we're going to see where this goes.
Okay.
Right?
Sounds good.
And out of her vagina was purple dye. Okay. And now I'm going to have sex with this woman. I'm going to be going down on her. She's going to be going down on me. I'm going to be fingering her. She's going to be grabbing my cock. We're going to be making out. We're going to have a fantastic, sweaty, you know, amazing time. And yes, we're going to use a condom for penis and vaginal sex. But still, at the end of that sex, you know, assuming we did it right and had a great time, I'm going to be completely covered in purple and black dye. Right? I mean, fluids move around during sex, no matter if you throw that condom on for that 10 minutes of cowgirl or, you know, 15 minutes of missionary. Fluids are moving around during sex. And so to me, I would use it in any situation where I'm having sex with someone that I don't know their status. And just like I illustrated earlier, just because someone says they have been STI tested recently, they probably think they know their status, but don't. And, you know, I just want to tag on to the end here that I'm extremely sex positive. We're all going to die of something someday, and it's not going to be gonorrhea. But the fact is, like, you know, if we're in the lifestyle and we're really careful about STIs, we just have to think about these things a little bit deeper than how I think all of us have thought about them in the past.
Yeah, you're right. Because when I hear the term exposure, in my mind, I think immediately, okay, no protection. I think condom breakage. Those are the things that kind of pop into my mind when I think, okay, what is exposure? Whereas, you know, what we know in the reality, and using your black and purple dye analogy, is that exposure is there regardless, you know, and every time we go into, you know, a sexy, fun environment, we are weighing up the pros and the cons of the risk. Side note, I just made a note to myself here that I'm going to send you one of those like sex paint kits that you can get. So I really want to see you and your partner actually make a sexy little painting. So let's talk about DoxyPep, and I'm going to throw this back over to Dr. Stoa. How does DoxyPep differ from traditional methods of preventing STIs? And, you know, we just spoke a moment ago about barriers, condoms, dental dams. What sets it apart in terms of its efficacy and its convenience?
I guess for efficacy, a pill doesn't break like condoms do. Condoms, they're convenient for the most part, but they do come off. They do break. You can have, you know, failures with condoms. All of us have had them in the lifestyle at some point. So you don't have to worry about failure due to an inappropriate device, shall we say. So that's one of the things that sets it apart in terms of efficacy. It's not 100% effective. Nothing really is, but the literature on it's actually pretty good for prevention. The traditional methods like dental dams, again, I've never even seen one in real life. And that's coming from a gynecologist who's been practicing for 14 years and preaches about sexually transmitted infection risk. So if that says something. Setting it apart, honestly, a lot of patients are really comfortable with taking medications, especially one like this where you don't have to like take it for a really long amount of time. You really just take it after sex. There's a little bit of kind of tweaking to go with that, but I think we'll get into it later as to how it's actually taken. But it does differ in that it works every time that you take it, as long as you take it properly and you don't have to worry about breakage and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And as I was doing research for this, I kept seeing this come up time and time and time again, which was the term that it's basically like the morning after pill, but for STIs. Like that was something that I think many of the articles that I researched really refer to this as. And you just said that before, as long as you're taking it pretty close after, and we're going to get into that a little bit later, the likelihood of this actually working and preventing is quite high. So I thought that was something particularly interesting because I think, yes, I personally see more people being interested in taking a medication, something that is a little bit more, okay, I feel good about this. And, you know, and sometimes these things do boil down to perception, right? You wake up the next morning and I go, okay, yeah, I had a great play session. I'm covered in purple and black dye. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, what's going to then make me wake up the next morning and feel even better about that? Maybe it is a pill. I don't know, you know. So I think the perception of that is also something that is easy to take. It's that, I mean, I take vitamins every day myself, but it's that kind of that morning kind of, okay, cool. And now I'm going to get on with my day.
Yes, that's correct. And the statistics, they kind of float around a little bit. I just wanted to throw it out there. Your reduction of risk for chlamydia and syphilis is about 70%. So 70% reduction over what you would have had. Chlamydia or gonorrhea is a little bit more debatable. Some of the studies say, yep, it works. And some of the studies say, no, it doesn't. So that one's a little bit more kind of out there.
Yeah, right. And I think, you know, and we'll get into this in segment two as well, is kind of the stats and the history on this and, you know, what to expect from it. But one of the things that I always like to do before my episodes is kind of reach out to social media. And I'm going to throw this over to your court, Robert. I asked our communities through social media if they would take that pill. So if they got up the next morning, would you get up, make your coffee, pour your OJ or whatever, and get your vitamins out, and then would you take a pill after exposure? And I went on to say specifically in the question that you were playing with barriers. So assuming again that people are wearing some form of barrier, that you were playing with barrier, but would you wake up the next morning and take it? And I have to say the results actually kind of shocked me. I expected a little bit more pushback because, again, as I mentioned earlier, the minute you talk about STIs, the lifestyle comes out to play, man. Everyone's got opinions on it. But 85% of people across basically all my social media platforms, Facebook, TikTok, Twitter, Instagram, said yes, they would actually take a pill, which shocked the hell out of me, Robert. But my question to you is, what are some of the major concerns that maybe you're seeing on the ground raised by non-monogamous communities for your actual community and from your clients?
A lot of the concerns are about antibiotic resistance. And, you know, to be honest with you, that is something that public health experts are still wrestling with and studying. As the doctor pointed out earlier, these STIs are increasing across the country and it is becoming an emergency type of status. And of course, it requires vast amounts of antibiotics to treat these STIs. So the thought is, let's use a little dose of antibiotic to reduce the likelihood of having to use, you know, a nuclear bomb of antibiotics when someone actually has this colonized in their system. So the antibiotic resistance is one of them. Contradictions with other medications, in particular birth control and women having concerns about, you know, their vaginal health, because I think a lot of women have had the experience of having to be put on antibiotics, an entire course of antibiotics, which is a little different story than a single dose, you know, a few times a year, but then having concern about their vaginal health. So I would say those are the main concerns that I'm hearing back from people. And when I read your, and for those of you that don't know, Kate does a tremendous job of prepping for these interviews. She really does a lot of work behind the scenes, more so than I've seen other podcasters do. It's really fantastic. When I saw the comments that you directed me to from social media, you know, a lot of it, people are like, I just use protection. Well, you know, we've already talked about that. Or, I just get tested. No, we've already talked about that. And a lot of people are throat swab tested for STIs. So I was a little bit surprised at that data too. But to sum it up, yeah, those are the concerns that people have, you know, contradictions, vaginal health, and those sorts of things.
First of all, thank you very much for the compliment. That's probably my OCD coming out there, Robert. But you actually led me into my hot seat question, which is about antibiotic resistance. So I'm going to hand this over to the doctor in the house, Dr. Stower. What measures are in place to mitigate, perhaps, to your knowledge, dealing with DoxyPep and antibiotic resistance?
As far as I know, it's a concern, but there's not a lot of current data on it. I was kind of looking up to see what antibiotic resistance specific to the things that we're using this for. Fortunately, chlamydia does not have resistance to doxy, which is good. Gonorrhea does, depends on which study you look at. Somewhere between 15 and 25% of gonorrhea is resistant to doxy. So that may be why some of the studies are showing that this works for gonorrhea and some of the studies are showing that it doesn't. There is also a problem that when you take this medication, even in PrEP type form, it may not cause an increased resistance to the things you're treating, like chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, but it does cause resistance to other things. For instance, in one of the studies, when doxycycline was taken, it increased the risk for doxy-resistant Staphylococcus aureus up to 15%. So it's not always just the thing that you're treating that develops resistance. It can be other potential classes that we would use this antibiotic for that become resistant, and that can be problematic. Staph aureus typically causes skin infections, but it can cause infections in a lot of different places in the body. So you have to kind of consider that. We do know in science that this could be a potential problem long term. We just don't have a lot of data on it right now.
And Dr. Stower, apologies if this might sound a bit of a silly question, but again, please remember that I'm non-medical. When we talk about resistance in particular, when I think about antibiotic resistance, in my mind, what comes up immediately is like a long-term use, like day in, day out use. But what we're talking about with DoxyPep is maybe, you know, say I have, 10 sexual encounters, 15 sexual encounters a year, I would use it 10 or 15 times. Would antibiotic resistance, is that normally something that happens or occurs when you are taking more of a prolonged, consistent dose of something versus maybe if I just took DoxyPep, you know, a couple of times a year? Is that, does that have any, grounding or a difference? Again, please excuse my mumbling here, but again, non-medical. Does that change anything when it comes to antibiotic resistance?
Yeah, I actually know exactly what you're talking about. And oddly enough, it's exactly opposite of what you think. So when you take a drug long-term, it's less likely to develop antibiotic resistance for what you're taking it for. That's why when you have an upper respiratory infection or a sinus infection, your doctor says, make sure and take all of your antibiotics. It's because they're trying to prevent antibiotic resistance.
Right.
So if you only take 2 to 3 days of the antibiotic, the bug gets exposed to it, but it's not killed. It will then develop a mechanism to avoid being killed the next time it's exposed to the same drug. So taking DoxyPep is actually probably more likely to cause antibiotic resistance than taking a long-term dosing protocol.
All right. Thank you. And thank you again for weeding through that question and coming out the other side, knowing what I was trying to get across.
I've got you.
Thank you. Okay. Gold star advice for someone who might be listening to this and considering the use of DoxyPep, what key factors should they keep in mind, and how could that person make an informed decision about using it and their sexual health strategy? I'm happy to have either of you or both of you answer that question.
I'll start with this one and then I can let Robert take over. I think it's probably time to mention that there is no benefit, as far as we know, medically for DoxyPep in vagina owners. DoxyPep, what we've got right now for data, is all in males and predominantly in men who sleep with men and in trans men who still use their vaginas for penetration. So most of the data we have is in men. There is one study that I could find that was somewhat of a decent study, but it was in sub-Saharan Africa, so not really generalizable to the entire world, that it doesn't work in women.
And when someone's considering it, you know, is there questions that they should be asked? Like if you were to have, say, for example, if I was coming to you from an OBGYN perspective and I said, Dr. Stower, this is happening, you know, what sort of questions would you want maybe me to ask that medical health professional when I'm considering the use of it?
So from the medical perspective, again, for women, we don't know that it works. We actually have some data showing potentially that it doesn't. Usually the first thing I would do is make sure the patient doesn't have any type of contraindications to doxycycline. There are a handful of them. Allergic reactions are not actually too uncommon with doxycycline, unfortunately. Kidney and liver problems are contraindicated. Lupus, which is a particular type of autoimmune disorder, has a contraindication to doxycycline. And people with myasthenia gravis. Those are kind of the big ones. Obviously, pregnancy and breastfeeding are absolute no-nos. Doxycycline can cause problems with the fetus, and it does get passed through the breast milk. So that would be one of the things, is making sure they don't have any contraindications to it. You would want to be sure that the patients are engaging in high-risk type environments. If they have been appropriately tested, including orally, and their partner has been as well, and neither one of them is positive for any of the things you're using it for, then it's not necessary. And trying to be good stewards to avoid any type of antibiotic resistance down the line. If everybody's been tested and everybody's negative, then we should be able to go without. I would still recommend using protection, even if everybody's been appropriately tested, including orally, because tests aren't perfect either. But using DoxyPep is probably overkill in those types of situations.
Now, I know we've spoken a lot about vaginal owners, vulva owners, and perhaps the studies aren't out there. And I think it's important to mention that funding for this sort of thing is not common. And I mean, you mentioned it earlier, Dr. Stower, in your intro, that, you know, there hasn't historically been a lot of funding in general for women's health. So when we look at the funding that's given to health in general, you know, where the funding's actually used, generally women's health is very, very far down the chain. So I know there are some current studies that are kind of undergoing for this, but again, another, you know, medical question from a non-medical person on the phone. When I was looking at those studies that had said, you know, we've done a lot of research in gay and bisexual men using it, and predominantly the reasons for that is because of anal sex. But hey, we haven't done a lot of research on it because women only use their mouths and their vulvas to have sex. I actually really love anal. So my question is then, wouldn't some of those studies kind of merge almost between them? Like if I look at, say, if I'm having anal sex a couple of times through the year with within the lifestyle community, again, protected anal sex, but still anal sex, wouldn't some of those studies relating to men and the reason for it being used is because of anal sex, wouldn't that relate to me as a female? You know, when I looked at all the studies, it spoke a lot about just, oh, because you're using your mouth and your vagina. And I'm like, well, hello, anal sex lady over here. Any thoughts on that, Dr. Stower?
So yeah, there's the biggest problem is exactly what you were talking about. There's not a lot of data on it in women. Now, there are some differences as to how women and men metabolize things. So theoretically, doxy is metabolized fairly similar from males to females, as far as I know. The chances of this being more effective in receptive anal sex for vagina owners is probably pretty high, but we don't have enough data for me to say that for absolutely sure. So could it cross over? Yeah, absolutely. Theoretically, would that make sense medically and scientifically? Yes, but I can't prove it.
Yes. And also just taking, you know, if you're out there and you've got a gazillion dollars and you happen to be listening to our podcast, feel free to give us some for additional testing for women, for God's sake. Let's maybe move on to section two. So treatment and why we might use it. Continuing our deep dive into DoxyPep here, and I'm going to talk about, again, with treatment protocol, potential side effects. We've touched on a little bit about that holistic approach and, you know, can or should we adapt it in the non-monogamous lifestyle in our non-monogamous relationships? We spoke about the treatment. You mentioned, Dr. Stower, after perhaps exposure, you know, people could take it. What is the recommended treatment protocol, just really in black and white terms, for dosage, for timing, and are there any other considerations that we need to share with people?
Sure. So the current dosing is 200 milligrams of doxycycline taken by mouth twice within 24 hours, no later than 72 hours. So what I tell my patients, if I'm prescribing it for them, is that you need to take it after sex, and then 24 hours later, you take another dose. If you have another unprotected exposure after that second dose or in between those second doses, you could take it again 24 hours later. So you can take it daily if you're having sex daily unprotected with multiple partners. Bless you if you have enough time and energy for that. You can take this daily every 24 hours at 200 milligrams.
Right. And I'm assuming, like any other medication, that you would not want to go over and above that. Like I remember years ago, and I hate to trivialize this, but I had my wisdom teeth out and my sister, I got some antibiotics, and my sister in her, you know, infinite wisdom said, oh, well, okay, if one pill is helping her a day, then surely five pills today must be great for her. And it was actually penicillin, and she gave me an allergic reaction to penicillin. So I'm assuming that there's a, with that, you mentioned that the 200 grams or milligrams rather, I'm assuming that you wouldn't go above and beyond that within that 24 hour period if you did have another exposure?
That would be correct. Yeah, you don't want to take it more than, you can take it twice a day for other things, but then you're increasing your risk for side effects and also for stuff like allergic reactions. So yeah, don't overdose on that stuff.
We've spoken about some of the potential side effects, but not all of them. So maybe can we just run through some of the side effects? I noticed one was maybe some issues with sun exposure. So it recommended the use of, say, sunscreen if you're using it, fairly common. What are some of the other potential side effects mentioned?
Yeah, the sun exposure thing is actually fairly common. People will become kind of hypersensitive to being exposed to the sun. That doesn't mean it has to be warm out. It just needs to be sunny. People will sometimes break into like a head-to-toe rash. It's really unpleasant. So you want to cover your skin and or use sunscreen, preferably after using doxycycline, just to make sure you don't get that lovely little reaction. Most commonly, other than that, and that one's not actually that common. It's just one of the ones that everybody's really shocked by when it happens to them. GI discomfort is probably by far the number one thing that people have. Upset stomach, especially diarrhea, which isn't super fun when you're at a resort and having unprotected sex. Constipation can happen as well, but diarrhea is much more common. And like that kind of like bloating, nausea, GI, I just don't feel good tummy-wise. Those are probably the biggest ones. That can proceed into bloody diarrhea, especially if you're taking multiple doses. Other stuff is a little bit less common. Things like hives, even without being exposed to the sun. If it affects your kidneys, it can cause your urine to darken quite a bit. That would be something that you would want to have checked out immediately. Dizziness and headaches are not uncommon as well. And then there's some more severe things like anaphylactic reactions, which are really uncommon.
Yeah, right. Because I'm just thinking about the antibiotics that I've had in the past. And normally there is always some form of, you know, you might get stomach upset. Like, I feel like that's a fairly common thing that I see on medication that's given to me. So, I think that's why people said about the sunscreen was because it seems it's not common that you get that. I feel like every medication always tells me to be careful for diarrhea, but very rarely will I see a medication saying, hey, slip, slop, slap, you know, it's sunny out there. So yeah, thank you for sharing all of that. Really appreciate that. Robert, over to you. I'm going to handball it over to your court. So on your website, so shamlesscare.com, where you talk about STI prevention, you recommend, the annual package recommends 30 tablets. So that would be 15 sexual encounters. I was curious about that number. I'm curious about where the number came from. Was that some sort of like average number of sexual encounters that people have on an annual basis? And my second question was, if you were in a couple situation, would it be possible if you had less encounters or you just wanted to split or share the subscription or share those pills? Is that something that actually can be done, or do each of those people need to have their own subscription because they need to talk to a doctor?
Sure. Well, here in the United States, it's a prescription drug and people should never share prescription drugs. People should have their own prescription and their, you know, their own medication. So we have a team of board certified physicians. Every medical provider on our team is a board certified physician, and they operate really with complete autonomy. And our medical director, when I first approached him with the idea for DoxyPep, he thought it over for a couple of days and did some research. And it was his decision to do 15 doses a year as a quote unquote year supply, not because that was like the average number of sexual partners that somebody had or anything like that. That's just what he felt comfortable with giving under a single prescription. We have had patients who have not refilled, but reordered. And then, you know, it's like a brand new case goes right back to that same position located in their state. And some of those people have been given another prescription, which you could think of as a refill, I suppose. But that was entirely his decision and just kind of based upon his, you know, sound medical judgment.
I mean, first of all, I love the response there. Thank you, Robert. But in the back of my head, I got to tell you, I was legitimately thinking that somebody was there with a piece of paper and a pen and like interviewing all these different people about how many sexual partners they'd had in a year, and they come up with this average. And that's kind of, I was like, where, how do we sign up for these sexual studies? I volunteer as tribute. But that's really interesting. So people are still going through the process. They're still going and meeting with the doctor online, I guess, talking about the history and everything else, and then getting their own subscription. And thank you for the reminder to not share subscription medication, or sorry, not to share prescription medication. I will slap myself on the hand for that comment. Robert, also, you mentioned earlier in the show, and as you know, we've had many conversations about this, I'm a big advocate for vulva health, particularly as it pertains to pH balance, because this is an antibiotic. Outside of talking about the fact or antibiotic resistance, what are the potential side effects of pH balance? So what should I know as a vulva owner if I'm considering taking this preventative measure with DoxyPep?
I'll just say something really quickly and then hand it over to her. Obviously, she's the expert. I just want to point out that when people do order medication at shamlesscare.com, they have an opportunity to talk to their physician there. And there are certainly people that ask really great questions like this and then get the answer and then decide not to go forward with the medication. And it's just important to realize that, you know, I'm a guy who just got really passionate about the lifestyle, is doing everything he can to prevent STIs, but, you know, I'm certainly not a physician, and there are a lot of questions that should only be answered by a physician like Dr. Storr.
Fair, thank you.
Okay, I'll take over from there. Thank you, Robert. Appreciate that. As far as pH balance, one of the things that's actually really a bonus about doxycycline is it does not seem to offset the normal vaginal pH in most women. We actually use doxycycline to treat bacterial vaginosis, depending on what strains you have going on. So it doesn't typically alter in a bad way the pH balance in vagina owners. So you should be able to use doxy with little to no concern for your general vaginal health.
That's incredible. You've actually floored me over here, Dr. Stowa, because we've been talking a lot about vaginal health recently. We actually just did an episode for Our Swingers Health about vaginal health. And, you know, we were talking, there was three ladies on the phone, two medical professionals and myself, and we were all sharing our stories and our woes and everything about, you know, BV and thrush and all this kind of stuff. And particularly, you know, if you do get sick and you get a round of antibiotics and then you have to then deal with thrush.
Yeah, those are actually uncommon with tetracyclines in general. It's usually the penicillins. There's lots of different drugs that can cause offset pH, but penicillins are kind of the classics and cephalosporins, but tetracyclines don't typically cause offset vaginal pH.
Wow. Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that, because I was expecting us to go into a very heated discussion about all these things that we should be taking, and we don't need to do that. So that's great. Mm-hmm. Maybe over to you, Robert. So in the context of non-monogamous relationships, how would you see DoxyPep fitting into a comprehensive sexual health approach, and what measures should individuals consider alongside its use? I know we spoke about barriers, but is there anything else in your mind that we need to think about as a community?
Well, DoxyPep is a tool, and it's the right tool for a lot of people. It's the wrong tool for some others. You know, I think for anyone in the lifestyle, quality testing is probably the more urgent matter. You know, I was just at Hedonism in January, and I was there representing Shameless Care. I had an opportunity to talk to dozens of people in the lifestyle, and not a single one of them had been throat swab tested. And I'm here to tell you, as somebody who has tested swingers now over the past 2 years, those are the infections that people are most likely to have, is a gonorrhea or chlamydia infection of the throat, because of all the things that we've already talked about. Bacterial infections spread very readily. They're often asymptomatic in the throat, and you know, rarely tested for, quite frankly. And so there are probably people who go to hotel takeovers or cruises or resorts or just out on dates. They have brand new, you know, test results from their physician showing they're STI free. And unfortunately, some of them just aren't. And so getting proper testing with throat swabs, to me, is a much more important tool than DoxyPep. But I do think that DoxyPep, for people who are engaging in higher risk activities, like a lot of us do, and quite frankly, enjoy in the lifestyle, can be the right tool for those people. But to me, the proper STI testing is just foundational, because, you know, I had the experience of getting I hate this term, but a lot of people use it, so forgive me, I'll use it, all clean STI result. And guess what? I wasn't. I had a completely asymptomatic gonorrhea infection in my throat. And there's hundreds, if not thousands, of people like me out there right now. And so testing, to me, is such a bigger part of the picture than DoxyPep. But DoxyPep does have a place in the health world.
Thank you, Robert. I had a hot seat question, which was going to be talking about the lack of supporting evidence for certain population groups. And I think we've already covered that. Dr. Stower and I kind of mentioned earlier about that. So I kind of want to flip this on its head, actually, and share a bit of a story with you both. So what we see, and I think, Robert, you can probably echo this, but we are seeing more male-on-male play in public spaces within the non-monogamous lifestyle. I personally feel like we are actually coming, you know, moving ahead a little bit with less stigma, less shame around male on male play, which is really fantastic to see. Robert, are you seeing that in your events and in the lifestyle community where you are as well?
Absolutely. We have a weekly online event called Talk Sex, just kind of augment our parties, and they're trivia games. And so we do surveys as a result of that to create these trivia questions. And, you know, somewhere around 80%, it kind of fluctuates, but somewhere around 80% of the men in our group are either consider themselves to be bisexual or bicurious. And I don't know what that would have been 10 years ago, 20 years ago, but nowhere near that. So yeah, I think as people feel more comfortable, a lot of men are certainly exploring their own sexuality a little bit more.
Which is absolutely fantastic. And I think, you know, when we're talking about before, I kind of did just glaze over when I spoke about, you know, me enjoying anal, and I spoke, you know, about gay men. I kind of did leave out the bisexual man out of that originally. And what we are seeing is more and more by play at events. So I kind of almost, on a personal level, I almost see DoxyPep really fitting into that category of people really, really well in the swingers lifestyle. But my personal story is that I was recently down in Australia. I haven't been there for a very long time. And I was sitting with a group of friends, some vanilla friends. I had my partner, Daryl, there. I had some gay friends there. And we were all just really having a talk about sexual health, because one of our friends has recently become single and he's out there in the dating market. And Robert, you'll probably keel over and die about this, but I said, oh, you know, about testing. And he went, what? I've never been, oh, what do you mean? I've never been tested. And I was like, wait a second, you're on Tinder and you're like dating and you've never been tested. Like what? Well, hold on a second. So we had this really long conversation about sexual health, about testing. And then, of course, our gay friends kind of wanted to join in the conversation. And they told me that over the last few years in Australia, they've noticed a real shift away from barrier play and actually more having no barrier play. And they mentioned they've actually been taking DoxyPep themselves for quite a while because more and more people in the gay community in Australia are playing that way. So it was a really interesting, if I can make a pun, fluid conversation that we had down in Australia about kind of sexual health and testing and DoxyPep and everything else. And I just couldn't believe that one of my friends, very, very close friend of mine, has actually been taking this for quite some time.
Yeah, but it's important to know that these only reduce the likelihood of contracting these three STIs that we've been talking about today. But a lot of men who have sex with men are taking PrEP, a completely different drug, an antiviral. And, you know, we actually live in a really wonderful time. I know it doesn't sound like it. We've been talking a lot about all these super scary STIs, but HIV, while still a concern, is not the death sentence it was even just a few years ago. And we have some tools to prevent that. And now we have some additional tools to help lower the likelihood of contracting some of these bacterial STIs. So all things considered, I dare say that we live in a pretty wonderful time when it comes to STIs.
And sexual exploration, as we just discussed there, with more and more bisexual men coming out to play. We absolutely love that. As we're getting ready to wrap up today's episode, I just want to hand it over to you, Dr. Stoer. Is there anything else that you'd like to add about DoxyPep, about talking to your physician, about talking or opening up to a medical professional, or, you know, what to consider? Anything else you'd like to add?
For sure. Again, as a gynecologist, it doesn't happen as much in my practice. I do sometimes bring it up with my patients if they do mention that they have a lot of anal play. If their husbands, which fairly often happens, or their partners are there with them, sometimes I'll bring it up. Hey, this is something you can consider asking your primary care doc. One of the things that I would highly encourage all people in alternative sexual lifestyles to do is to talk to your primary care physician about your lifestyle. I know it's scary. I know you're worried about there being some amount of guilt or shame associated with that, and there shouldn't be, but there may be. And in my opinion, if you bring this up with your doctor and they either blow it off or they give you a vibe of being super uncomfortable with it, time to find a new primary care doc. So definitely talk with your providers about this. Asking for something like DoxyPep, just know that if you are a vagina owner, the likelihood is that your provider will not prescribe that, as there is just so little evidence for the benefits of it. But if you do have the right provider and you talk about the risks and benefit association, a lot of people will prescribe it off-label. So that's just something to kind of keep in the back of your mind.
And Robert, anything else to add from your perspective, from shameless care, or just even in your local community, what you're seeing out there? Anything, any kind of wisdom you would like to impart before we exit today's show?
No, I really appreciate your time. You know, we're doing everything we can at Shameless Care to help address this issue. I wholeheartedly agree that people should talk to their physicians about these things. But if you're not getting the testing that you need from your physician, and by the way, I guess I should mention this, you know, feel free to go to shamelesscare.com and you can even screenshot what we call the perfect panel, which I know is, there's no such thing as a perfect panel, but we had to call it something. Screenshot the tests that are offered on that perfect panel and feel free to take that into your primary care physician or your OB or whoever's doing your testing. And if they won't offer those things, then find somebody else who will. But if they will, then that's fantastic. And you got all of those things for just the cost of your copay.
Absolutely fabulous. And I do want to, yes, again, close this episode with mentioning that we have been talking about, you know, medical advice today. Again, I'm non-medical, but at the end of the day, absolutely all medical advice should be sought by licensed professionals with your specific medical history in mind, which I know Robert mentioned before that you would discuss that with anybody before receiving any kind of medication anyways. Feel free to set up a call if you want through the shamelesscare.com website, or as Robert mentioned before, screenshot that if you're after STI prevention or just want to know about the STI testing panels. You can screenshot that and take that over with your specific requirements. But it has been absolutely fabulous. Dr. Stoer, again, thank you so much for your time. We really, really appreciate it when medical experts like yourself give us the time of day and come on the podcast and listen to me ramble. So thank you very much, Dr. Stoa.
Absolutely. Appreciate you having me.
And thank you for decoding what I was trying to say to you earlier. I really appreciate that. And Robert, as always, from Shameless Care, thank you very much for joining us on the show today. And again, talking about your local community and what you're seeing within the industry as well. Really appreciate you.
Thank you.
All right, guys, that has been Volume 7 for Swingers Health, and that is all about STI prevention. So thank you very much for listening to the show. I hope that you got something out of it. We really appreciate you taking the time to listen to these slightly more serious topics, but very, very important in the swingers and non-monogamous lifestyle. So have a great day, guys, and we'll see you again soon.